Well, welcome to another Weber Training Teleclass, Infection Control in Doctor's Offices. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Tatar of the University of Ottawa, I'd like to welcome you to this teleclass. Now, my sister is a family doctor, and I am constantly in wonder at the longevity of the magazines and toys in her waiting room. I can imagine how many mouths and little hands and things must have come into contact with those articles, and probably many of which have been there since the mid-80s. Many jurisdictions have recently produced recommendations and guidelines on controlling infectious disease in doctors' offices, and to have a good go at collecting all of that information into something coherent and specific, I have invited my friend Jim Gauthier to speak with us. Jim is an infection control professional, an author, a teacher, and an internationally recognized speaker. He has an incredible ability to research a topic and then present it in a very coherent, useful, and usually entertaining way. He's given several teleclasses in the past, and they are always outstanding. But before Jim begins his presentation, I would like to note that this teleclass is being sponsored by my friends at Johnson Diversey. These guys offered to help way back in 2001 when we were just getting started with this teleclass initiative, and they have been with us all along. Thanks very much to them. I will also point out that teleclass education does not advertise or promote any particular product or company. We're just glad to have companies who are willing to sponsor for education alone. Now, to present the teleclass, Infection Control in Doctors' Offices from Kingston on the shores of Lake Ontario, it is my honor to once again introduce Jim Gauthier. Jim.
Thank you very much, Paul, for that introduction. You always make me think, is he talking about me? We'll see how coherent we can make this subject. Infection control in doctors' offices has been near and dear to me for quite a few years as I've worked my way through various aspects of my infection control career. And when I was in British Columbia, I did do some consulting to doctors' offices, and it gave me a good insight when you're invited in. First of all, they're paying you money, so you want to make sure you're doing a good job for them. And when you read through the literature and look at the actual working conditions, the practice conditions, the background of some of the people that work in these offices, it was an eye-opener for me. And further into the presentation, I think I'll be referring to that the infection control practitioner that's listening in here, your services are required in some of these areas. And if you have the time and the want to get up and get out there and do it, there's a lot of good that we can take into these offices to make sure that they're working as well as they can. Because a lot of times this is the kind of information that has not been readily available. And as Paul mentioned, there are many different organizations putting out some recommendations. And I will discuss some of the ones that I was able to find and again offer my perspective on what I think we need to be heading. So the first slide that I have up here is my objectives of what I want to do. And as any good infection control practitioner, we will start by discussing some routine practices that can be performed anywhere, be it a doctor's office or an acute care hospital and everything in between. We need to look at the entire spectrum of care that we offer in healthcare. And when do we need to add additional precautions? And when do we need to pull out the masks, pull out the gloves, pull out the gowns? SARS taught us a lot about transmission, and we had the SARS virus in various parts of the world being transmitted in waiting rooms, in doctors' offices, in emergency wards, and some of the stuff we learned from that I will touch on again here as we work through. Some of the issues in the physician's office or the doctor's office that we need to look at is the cleaning and sanitizing that goes on, when we need to disinfect, when we need to sterilize, the risks that are inherent to having a group of sick people gathering in small areas. And I will even touch on the magazines and stuff like that that Paul was referring to. If we go to the next slide, Jim's Basics, for those of you that know my name through the APIC list, you may or may not agree with me, but I always try to get things down to the basics and to look at what we're here for. My first basic is we are buggy people. And I don't care how well I showered this morning or if I continue to shower through the rest of the morning, I've got bugs on me. and there's no way of me getting away from that. And all of our patients that go to doctor's offices have bugs on them. Our doctors have bugs on them. The office staff have bugs on them. And once we get our head wrapped around that, I'd like to focus on that, that there are bugs there, and I don't worry so much about the fancy names. To me, it doesn't really make a difference whether the bug has a name of Stenotrophis multifilia or Acinetobacter calcoaceticus. There's a bug there. Some bugs are more important than others in terms of disease transmission. Where you find them, and the whole background that I utilize as an infection control practitioner. But in the doctor's office, people are coming into that office with bugs on them, which will include viruses also. The label of the superbug, I put into quotes here because I really do not appreciate that term. It's caused my life a lot of problems when I have to work around these labels of superbugs. The ones listed here, the MRSA, or methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, VRE, for vancomycin-resistant enterococci, and the Clostridium difficile that is making news both in Canada into Quebec. We've seen outbreaks of this new virulent strain in Britain, and we've having reports coming up from the Eastern Seaboard to the United States. The superbug label looks great in the media, but as I said, it causes me some headaches here. My next slide of basics. I don't care about the bugs. I appreciate that the bugs are there. There are always people around who can pick up these bugs and be affected by these bugs in very bad ways. What we need to focus on is how that happens, or the mode of transmission. Generally, we're going to spread bugs by picking it up from a surface or a patient on our hands and transferring it to another patient. We will also spread things if we have equipment that has not been cleaned properly or disposed of when it should be disposed of. And we're spreading bugs when we cough, sneeze, snort, or carry on. The SARS lesson comes up with the coughing, sneezing, snorting, and I'll cover some of the stuff that we can do just as routine precautions in all of our practices. So the next slide on routine practices, that's our Canadian term. That is the equivalent of the standard precautions in the United States. And it's an adaptation of all the stuff that we've learned over the years through universal precautions and body substance precautions. And the premise is we just assume everybody is infectious. Everyone has some form of a bug or a virus that is going to make us sick. And we work on any time we are going to come in contact with blood or body fluids, any kind of an excretion, secretion, or any object soiled with these substances, we have to protect ourselves in a routine manner all the time. From this slide, to me, feces is feces. It doesn't matter too much to me whether feces has C. difficile in it or whether it doesn't have it in it. I try to focus on the substance that I am working from and the assumption that it always has something nasty in it. Feces is an easy thing to make that assumption with. My next slide, routine practices, when we look at our hand stuff, the basic cornerstone of all infection control that we, for the ICP, we must say thousands of times in a year is hand hygiene. We have to do something to clean our hands. We can use soap and water, not a bad product. It's been around 150, 200 years to be used as regular function to actually clean our hands, but it's very technique dependent. The 10 to 15 seconds that we all try to get people to do, we really know should be 15 to 30 seconds for a social hand wash to remove those transient bugs that we have picked up, to get rid of the soil and other debris that we may have on our hands. The technique dependent, I did a presentation at my facilities for Infection Control Week where I have my staff, visitors, patients in many cases, come by my booth, and I put on a pair of regular vinyl disposable gloves. I add a dollop of red finger paint to their palms and say to them, close your eyes and show me how you lather your hands if this was soap and your hands were bare. And many people would look at me going, Jim, I know how to wash my hands. I don't need to do this demonstration. I ask them to humor me, tell them they can enter the draw if they do it. And they find out how technique dependent this is, because you find with the red finger paint where you don't rub your hands. And I had some healthcare providers who spent 10 to 15 seconds saying happy birthday to you or the alphabet song and all the stuff we try to teach them, rubbing their hands and totally missing a thumb, a back of a hand. And we know people tend to clean their non-dominant hand better than their dominant hand. And this became a very visual way for people to check. For any doctors that might be listening in, it's a real easy check to do with your staff just to explain to them the mechanics behind hand washing to make sure that they're doing it well. And it's a good way for the doctor to check to make sure that they are rubbing all surfaces of their hands. The technique-dependent component of this comes from, as I explained to the people that are doing this, you have to rub the surface of the hand with the soap to remove the bug and debris. And if you're not rubbing an area of your hand, you're not removing the bugs from that part of it. And it's a good check. Now, my next slide discusses using an antibacterial soap where you leave a residue of substance on your hands to continue killing the bacteria. Again, we still have to rub our surfaces of our hands to make sure that we are going to remove the organisms from our hand as best we can and wash them down the drain. The residue that is on our hands can be irritating in many circumstances. And when I work with the different soap manufacturers around their antibacterial products, they have their little techniques that they want to see you do so that the soap does not end up being as irritating to your hands. Do we need it in a routine general practice doctor's office? I'm not really sure. The recommendations were there that you should be using this before invasive procedures. So if it's lumps and bumps days where you're actually going to do a small excision of a lesion, you may want to use an antibacterial soap on your hands before you apply your sterile gloves to do your procedure. I still lean towards, I don't think we need antibacterial soap. I would prefer to see people utilize the alcohol hand sanitizing products on their visibly clean hands. If their hands was dirty, use a very mild soap appropriately, and then follow it up with the alcohol. So my next slide talks about the different hand sanitizers or the alcohol-based products. It's definitely easier on the hands than soap and water. That mechanical action that I've discussed of the rubbing and scraping and rinsing is taking all the natural oils off of your hands, whereas the alcohol hand sanitizing products do not remove that basic oil from your skin, but they have to be used in visibly clean hands. If you're soiled, you got to wash your hands. One problem I find with the sanitizers, and there was a good article in the American Journal of Infection Control concerning that, you have to have a good contact time. Allow this stuff to work. I generally now am recommending to people to put two pumps of the product on their hands to make sure your hands are wet for the 15 to 20 seconds. The technique is not as dependent. Most people will rub the alcohol into their hands so their hands are all wet. The residual and the drying action is actually taking care of the bacteria there. The discussion versus of gel versus liquid formulations, the liquids are mainly used throughout Europe. They tend not to use the gelled products at all, whereas North America seems to tend towards the gelled product and not to use the liquid product. And that discussion will go on for a while. I think more research is being done now as to the concentration issues. Is a 62 to a 70% alcohol concentration adequate for the contact time for the number of bacteria that we're trying to kill, or do we need to bump that up into the 75, 80, 85% range? Do we need to look at using various combinations? That research is still ongoing. One thing I do want to mention here about the different products that I've talked about, soaps and antibacterial products, is we should never be topping up these containers. Especially with the soap products, I know even in my own home, you buy the gallon jug of soap to fill up the small soap containers around the sink. In a practice or in a hospital, we should never be topping up any product, be it soap, be it disinfectants or anything like that. If you are buying in a large volume, the container that you're decanting into needs to be washed, rinsed, dried, and then refilled. And I've come across that in many of my audits that I've done in doctors' offices, that there's many products that are just topped up. So if we look at my next slide, I discuss the issue around alcohol and C. difficile, because I'm going to be talking about Clostridium difficile in a few slides from now. There's much discussion around whether we should even be using alcohol around patients that have Clostridium difficile, as alcohol is not a sporicidal agent. It does not kill spores. Laboratories actually shock stool specimens if they're trying to culture Clostridium difficile by putting the stool into alcohol to kill off the background flora to help remove the background flora and allow the Clostridium difficile to show up a little bit better. My feelings on this, I've published in the APIC list. If your hands are soiled, if you got stool on your hands, you need to wash them with soap and water. You're not going to use alcohol. If you've had no contact with the feces, do you need to use soap and water? If you've washed your practices, if the patient that has Clostridium difficile is in contact precautions, you haven't touched anything. If you have touched it, there's a minimum amount of soiling that's happened to your gloves. Can you actually then use the alcohol? If you've had contact with feces with gloves on, is that all still applicable? I know we always recommend and reinforce that you need to wash your hands or sanitize your hands once you remove gloves. And if we're going to make an issue around Clostridium difficile, should we be making this recommendation for any stool specimen that we might come in contact with? So to relate this to the doctor's office, if the doctor needs to perform a rectal exam where they will apply a glove, do we treat that exam differently if we know the patient has Clostridium difficile, or do we practice routine precautions and always wash our hands after we remove that glove? My concern, again, is about using the organism name. And I think we need to focus on what we're actually working with in terms of we've come in contact with feces on our gloves, you have to wash your hands. If you have not come in contact with feces and you've had gloves on, when you remove your gloves, your alcohol is going to take care of the organisms that are there. This debate is going to continue for a while, I'm sure. In routine practices, my next slide talks about the use of masks for both the doctor and staff. The picture that I've utilized here of our model wearing a surgical mask with eye protection of plastic goggles is one combination. The other combination would be a mask with an attached plastic face shield that have either the tie straps or the ear loop straps. This is necessary for any febrile coughing patient that you are going to get within one arm's length of. It's what we would refer to as droplet precautions in essence. The eye protection is very necessary also, as there's many viruses that can attack us or inoculate us through our conjunctiva. The next slide looks at two different styles of an N95 mask, the duck-billed and the cone-shaped. And as a routine practice, if you have a patient that you're suspicious might have tuberculosis or measles or chickenpox, we need to move up to the N95 or equivalent mask. There are recommendations that have just come out in Ontario where the language has been changed to an equivalent mask has been added into the definition. And that debate will go on again through many different areas of the country. If we're immune to measles and chickenpox, do we really need to have a mask on? Probably not. Some jurisdictions and some articles that I read did recommend, regardless, you should have a mask on if you're working with someone who has chickenpox or not. Routine practices on the next slide, again, discuss the patient wearing a mask. This helps limit the soiling in the environment if they are coughing. And if the patient, though, is not able to tolerate a mask or won't wear a mask, when you're working with demented adults or any kind of a mental illness, many patients will not be able to have the mask on like this. You need to then look at different aspects and different ways of making sure that we don't end up with soiling of the environment happening. The mask pictured here is what I would refer to as a procedure mask, where it hooks over the ears. And we have combinations like this in my facilities now with the attached plastic face shield. If you're putting this on a patient, they don't need the attached face shield. They just need this mask here. And this mask is also adequate for a patient where you are suspicious that they have tuberculosis. You never need to stick a patient into an N95 mask. To me, that's sort of cruel and unusual punishment. The patient, we're trying to cover their coughing and sneezing. We could hand them a wad of tissue and ask them to hold that over their face. The mask works in much the same manner. Glove use, anytime there's an anticipated contact with blood or body fluids, we should have a pair of gloves on, but they must be used appropriately to protect the environment. I love the picture here that I found where we have someone washing a pair of gloves. We never do that. I think that's a generally accepted standard now, that we would never wash gloves. But on the next slide, I discuss that we need to keep this gloves task specific. We need to make sure that we put them on for a very specific purpose and take them off when we are done. Gloves really are not required if we're touching intact skin, non-rash infested skin. There's always the fear of scabies being acquired from skin. We need to wash or sanitize our hands after removal, as I mentioned earlier, and we need to be drifting away from latex gloves. I think in many, many jurisdictions now, we are all trying to work with vinyl or other products such as the nitrile gloves. There are neoprene gloves, a more rubberized glove that are coming that are hypoallergenic and don't seem to be causing as many issues. I know in, at least where I hang out up here in Ontario, most of our paramedics now and emergency medical techs are using the nitrile gloves because they give a good tactile sense. They hold up well to the abuse that they may have to do in extricating a patient. The vinyl gloves are widely accepted throughout. My issue around the glove use, obviously, is keeping it task specific and making sure that we are not transmitting stuff by either touching ourselves with dirty gloves or touching the environment with dirty gloves. I should have probably included some pictures in here of people charting with their gloves on or utilizing the telephone with their gloves on. And again, those are practices we have to watch and make sure that we don't do. Abuse of gowns. The next slide is something that we should have available in doctor's offices if there is a chance of soiling our clothes. These can vary between plastic aprons that we may put on to cover the front of our clothes or a full cover gown that will cover our arms also. We definitely need to keep these as single patient use. And again, this is pretty standard, I think, in most of the doctor's offices I've hung out in recently. You don't find them having one gown to be used between patients, but you need to consider the use of lab coats that are worn in many jurisdictions between patients. The lab coat is put on as a symbol of who you actually are, that you actually work at the facility and stuff. But if it is being utilized as a protection of the street clothes underneath, it needs to be looked at in terms of laundering, how often it should be laundered, that kind of issue. So that's my routine practice talk, which applies to the doctor's office. The use of additional or transmission-based precautions is where I had some issue with some of the literature that I was reading and what I think really should be happening. And I'm open to discussion on this afterwards if people want to send me emails in the pro or con mode, and maybe we can summarize those after. The acute care sector has their contact droplet and airborne precautions that we add in when we require it for certain situations or certain diseases. In the non-acute settings, I know I'm right now putting together a presentation on, do we require contact droplet and airborne precautions in long-term care, in complex continuing care, and then in this group of the non-acute care settings is the physician office. So if we look why we have used traditionally in the acute care setting, where we use contact precautions on the next slide, we use it for the MRSA, the VRE, the Clostridium difficile antibiotic-resistant organisms. We'll pull out the gowns, the gloves, the signs on the doors, trying to limit access into the room for these organisms so that they aren't going to be spread in our facilities. My next slide, where I do discuss specifically in acute care, I make the comment, is if the patient is not soiling the environment, is it truly necessary to have the gown and gloves on for all activities in the room? The articles are coming out that, yes, it does help limit the spread. Hospitals that have instituted contact precautions seem to have less transmission of the organisms than facilities that don't use contact precautions. And a lot of this research has been done around VRE, MRSA. There's been analysis of the amount of soiling that happens on these gowns through inadvertent touching of the environment, where we can find the organism adhering to the gowns that have been worn into these isolation rooms. I know in my complex continuing care facility, we have gone to using contact precautions with the antibiotic-resistant organisms, and we have seen a minimal amount of spread since we put that in place for all people entering the room, be it family, visitors, or staff members. But I'm also trying to emphasize that any patient who is soiling the environment, anyone who has got increased amount of excretions, so if they're coughing, if they're sneezing, if they have diarrhea, if they're vomiting, we need to have some sort of barrier in place. And we need to clean in a very standard manner to make sure that we pick up this kind of stuff. And I'll talk about that more. So in the doctor's office, if you have someone who is soiling the environment, a patient that is coughing, sneezing, have a history of vomiting and is in a history of diarrhea, should we be looking at utilizing a form of contact or droplet precautions? Definitely, in terms of the airborne route, any suspicion of tuberculosis, you need to mask the patient or yourself. And here the N95 or equivalent is referring to the doctor and the staff. Masking the patient would be with a procedure mask. And you definitely need to have hand hygiene before and after contact with all patients. That is more of my routine practices that should go on in a doctor's office. Any patients who's soiling the environment, we need some protection. Tuberculosis for sure. And in there, we would include our measles and chickenpox, I guess. And then the hand hygiene before and after contact with any patient. So if we look at the waiting room, and I'm coming up to the magazines here, Paul, don't worry. We instituted a lot of screening in the post-SARS era, or during SARS and then in the post-SARS era. And I know now entering various medical offices, diagnostic areas such as X-ray and stuff, these signs are seeming to disappear again. And I think it's still very applicable. I think it's good to have some sort of entry sign to start the screening process that indicates if you have a fever and cough, please put on a mask, let the receptionist know. You could include in that if someone comes in with a rash or if their child has a rash, you may want to let the receptionist know so that we can have a separate area either a separate area to put these patients into, to put them into an examination room a little more quickly, or to set up sort of a well area and a sick area of your office just to give some space between these patients. The use of a sign, however, is going to have some language issues with it, depending where you're listening in from. Various parts of Canada, we would have to have the signs in English and in French. The part of Canada that I'm sitting in right now, English is the predominant language that would be spoken. Parts of the United States, you would probably want to have signs in English and Spanish. So the screening sign is a passive way of doing it. You may still need an active way of doing it when the patient reaches the receptionist for the receptionist to ask, are you exhibiting any signs of a fever or a cough? Please put this mask on, and then make sure that the procedures are followed after that. On the next slide about the waiting room, an immunocompromised patient coming in will also need some space around them. The whole issue of putting a mask on someone who has a low white blood count or is immunocompromised in other manners as a routine is controversial. And I know the document that came out about the hematopoietic stem cell transplant was indicating that fresh bone marrow transplant patients probably do benefit from wearing a mask. After that, once they've got some immune system coming back or some cell response, most of these illnesses are coming from their own flora that they do acquire. Being coughed on does not help. Being in a crowded waiting room is not a great thing for someone with a weakened immune system. And this is something that I think will need to be discussed on an office-by-office basis, what you are going to do with the patients that come in that you know have an extremely low immune system, whether you want to have them right into an empty waiting room to wait their turn. Are you going to provide them with a mask? In many cases, I know family-wise, I had staff members or family-wise, my sister-in-law was traveling with a mask when she went, and she just felt more comfortable wearing a mask in waiting rooms before her appointments. The patient with the MRSA and the VRE, this is where I had some trouble. One of the recommendations that I found indicated that doctors should practice contact precautions with patients that are known to have MRSA and VRE, and that the chart should be flagged, they should be moved to a separate area. Again, to me, that goes against our routine practices that we should have in place. A patient who has MRSA and is not soiling the environment, to me, is not a big risk. As we look at the amount of community-acquired MRSA that is occurring, as we look at the acquisition of MRSA into family members, I think trying to flag charts and trying to do something different with the known positives is going to give us a false sense of security. I would still prefer to see in the doctor's office everyone treated exactly the same. Anyone who has uncontrolled nasal discharge from an upper respiratory tract infection, we should try to handle them in a very consistent manner. They happen to have MRSA, we're going to handle that because of our basic routine practices that we're doing. Any patient who has been exhibiting signs and symptoms of vomiting, and there's a risk with that, we need to handle in a very specific manner. It doesn't matter too much what they have causing the vomiting. It's still vomit that we're working with. It has the potential to have lots of stuff in it. So Jim's perspective on this would be I would treat all patients exactly the same. If they're soiling the environment, we do something slightly different. If they're not soiling the environment, treat them in a very routine manner. And some of that, again, I'll discuss here in a couple of slides. Our office equipment. Cleaning is very important for reusable equipment. Anything that we're going to use on another patient needs to be cleaned, and then the equipment itself needs to be analyzed. I'll be discussing the Spalding classification here in a second. Anything that is labeled single use in a doctor's office must be single use. The symbol that I have in the lower right-hand corner there is the universal symbol now for a single-use item. Hopefully that's not new to anyone listening in on this. But if an article has that on the external packaging, it needs to be disposed of after use. There is a lot of discussion in the hospital setting with very expensive pieces of equipment that are labeled single use, whether they can be reprocessed by external bodies, whether they can be done internally with quality assurance checks. I'll leave that up to the hospitals to discuss. I think in the doctor's office, if it's labeled single use, it should be chucked after we are done with it. The need for disinfection and sterilization is based on what we use the equipment for, as we'll be discussing with Spalding's definitions here. And to me, disposable equipment is the best. I love my environment as much as the next person, but at the same time, I think in terms of the amount of time and effort we're going to spend trying to clean and make sure that these things are safe to use on multiple patients, it's probably easier to err on the side of using a piece of disposable equipment. So Spalding's classification should be familiar to most of you, where Dr. Spalding divided the use of a substance, or what we use a product for, into three different classes of critical, semi-critical, and non-critical. so that if something is entering a sterile body site or vascular system, it is considered a critical item and it needs to be cleaned and then followed by sterilization as a reprocessing step if it is labeled to be reprocessed. Anything coming in contact with intact mucous membranes or non-intact skin is going to require the semi-critical, it's considered semi-critical, and it needs to be cleaned and then high-level disinfection. And then we have our non-critical stuff that reads across on the chart. So if we go to the next slide about cleaning, cleaning is such a vitally important step that we tend not to do well in many cases of our healthcare settings. We're getting much better at it. And cleaning is going to remove the dirt and body substances that have accumulated on our object that we're using. I saw a reference to be to consider using a small dishwasher for anything that doesn't have a lumen in it. So if it's a basically flat-sided object, put it through a dishwasher as a cleaning step. The use of soap and water is obvious to remove some of the stuff. Enzymatic cleaners can be used to help facilitate this process, and it needs to be done as soon as possible after use. I know many clinics will place reusable items into some sort of a soaking solution just to keep them wet so that they can be cleaned. Something I do want to emphasize here in the cleaning step, though, is we should never be using our hand washing sinks in a doctor's office to clean equipment. We definitely want to have a separate sink that we're going to use to clean equipment removed from our hand washing sink. Part of this is if you are using an enzymatic soaking solution, there's many soaps, many of our hand soaps will inactivate enzymatic cleaners, and you don't want to have that happening. We also need to be very careful in our clinics that we separate our clean areas from our dirty areas. So the area where your dirty equipment is being reprocessed and cleaned and where it's then going to be moved over to be disinfected or sterilized. And then once it's removed from the sterilization and disinfection area, we need to have a designated, well-delineated clean area. In some of the audits that I have done, it's all in one room. And we stand a very huge risk of, as we remove our items after their disinfection process, they could be contaminated by other dirty items in the room. So I think that's something we always have to be very aware of in our office. The next slide discusses sterilization and the tabletop autoclave. The small autoclaves that handle, that you find in many medical clinics, they're very good products. They work very well, but they must have a maintenance schedule to make sure that they are operating properly. One thing that I ran into, again, I'm going back 6 or 7 years since I've actually audited a doctor's office, is many of these tabletop autoclaves are never challenged with a biological indicator. They are never given a spore strip to see if it can actually kill spores and do what it's supposed to be doing, which is sterilizing. How often should that be done? Whether it should be done daily, whether it should be done weekly, will depend on your local regulations. The Canadian Standards Association recommends a daily check. Many places, if it's used very infrequently, would want to run a spore check every time it's used to make sure that it is working. I know some facilities that will pull this back to a month. They'll do it monthly. And if you are doing that, you need to be doing it. It's not if you are. When you do it, you need to make sure that you have a good record of when this check was done, what the result was. You also need to have a process in place that if it doesn't work, if you do not kill the spores, that you've got some way of going back to try to figure out what pieces of equipment have been sterilized and what has happened to them in the interim. The document that I have a reference for later on in the presentation called Infection Control in the Physician's Office, put out by the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, has some good templates to use for keeping track of your equipment, for keeping track of the autoclaves. And they've got some pages there that you may want to look at if you're looking for some form to record this kind of stuff. A lot of times with the tabletop autoclaves, people will have a roll of autoclave tape that they stick on a product so that they know it's been through the autoclave. These tapes only show that a temperature was achieved inside the autoclave to make the tape go black. It doesn't show that the temperature was maintained or that the pressure was maintained for any time at all, and it's not an adequate check to make sure that something is sterile. Wrapping of the equipment is very important. If a product's not going to be used right away, you should have it wrapped either in a peel pack wrapping or into some form of a cotton layer that will allow the steam to penetrate through. You can purchase trays that will go into some of these autoclaves, the tabletop autoclaves, where it's sealed in the tray. After you've cleaned the product and dried them, you put it inside the autoclave, it comes out in the tray, and it maintains the sterility until you're ready to use it again. The next slide on sterilization discusses our chemical or cold sterilization. There's an issue with the cold sterilants around toxicity and ventilation, and we've seen many changes, at least in the past 5 years, around products that we are allowed to use. Glutaraldehyde has fallen out of favor in many cases. depending on its concentrations, its composition. There's many different glutaraldehyde formulations, and some of them are more toxic in terms of the fumes that come off of it than other products. The problem with using your cold sterilization also, where you're actually soaking it in a solution, is how do you store the equipment after it has been sterilized, because it has been soaked, it's going to be rinsed, and then it has to be maintained in such a manner that it is still considered sterile. The cold, the chemical sterilants, especially the liquids, you're going to be using hours as opposed to minutes to process the equipment through. Many of these products will take upwards of 10 hours to overnight to achieve its sterility. And if you're going to rinse off the chemical, if you read the label claims of many of these products, you should be rinsing with sterile water, which is going to add a cost to it. And some of the products where they indicate that you want, say, 3 to 4 full rinses, if you're utilizing sterile water for that, that's going to add a lot of money to the process that you're using. There are new products being introduced all the time. The website that I've listed here through the FDA has a neat chart on it that I found. And it indicates across the type, it's a device evaluation information through the FDA cleared sterilants. So it's American based, but it does list the contact times to achieve sterility and the contact times for high level disinfection. The active ingredient is listed, and it lists many different brand names down here. So it's not all inclusive. Looking down it, I notice there's products that I'm familiar with that aren't on here. But some of the basic formulations of whether it contains hydrogen peroxide, whether it contains peracetic acid, glutaraldehyde, isopropanol, and various combinations therein, it's listed down. The one problem with this chart, though, is it does not list toxicity problems and requirements for ventilation, rinsing, and that kind of stuff. It doesn't have the label indications for what these things are to be used for. But I found it as a really sort of a quick chart. Take a look at what is out there if you're looking for other products. Disinfection. I already mentioned utilizing the chemical sterilants for use in high-level disinfection. Disinfection is broken down into high-level, intermediate-level, and low-level. High-level disinfection is going to kill all microorganisms with the exception of high numbers of bacterial spores. And the next slide after that has my little table that I like to use with our hardiest organisms at the top, the spores of Bacillus subtilis, Clostridium tetani, Clostridium difficile, and then boxed down the various other products. And you see where the high-level disinfection fits in. It kills small numbers of spores if it has the right contact time. And then it will take care of mycobacteria, your non-envelope viruses with the examples listed there, fungi, vegetative bacteria, and the envelope viruses. I actually saw a chart similar to this just not that long ago where the envelope viruses and the vegetative bacteria were switched. So I think we're still in roughly the same area down here at the bottom. The next slide shows that intermediate level disinfection in red here kills mycobacterium tuberculosis and the other ones that I just mentioned on the slide. And again, if you go to the slide following that, it shows the boxes to where intermediate level disinfection would fall in. And again, your low level disinfection is taking care of basically the vegetative bacteria and envelope viruses. And I show that with my little box on the next slide sitting down at the bottom. I find this a nice visual when I'm explaining to people how the different processes work. The thing to remember about high-level disinfection not handling large numbers of spores is if we clean well first, there shouldn't be a lot of spores present, and we should be achieving very close to the definition of sterility if we have worked with a very clean product first. At the same time, by definition, we will follow with the high, intermediate, and low-level disinfection steps here. My next slide on methodology is discussing that if we can sterilize, we should sterilize. It is preferred over high-level disinfection if the object can tolerate that or if it's available. It gets into that margin of safety that when we mention that we need to use high-level disinfection, that is sort of the standard that we're working at. But heck, if you can sterilize it, let's go that high. So the slide following that one on disinfection, usually it is done with liquid chemicals is what we're working with here. And I've listed some of the more common ones that we see as disinfectants are bleach, hydrogen peroxide, alcohol, and the stuff that I mentioned around glutaraldehyde. Quats are mainly used for cleaning or low-level disinfection, and we'll discuss that here in just a bit. So I do want to talk about these very briefly. My bleach solutions is offering us low to intermediate level disinfection at our 1 in 100 to 1 in 1,000 dilutions. There is some evidence that it will kill spores, and many facilities, again, are recommending if you've had a patient with Clostridium difficile, you should be using a concentrated bleach solution after the room has been cleaned to try to kill the spores that are going to be present in the environment. You do need high concentrations. It's very hard on our housekeeping staff to utilize it this way, and a long contact time. I know many clinics that I went into was using bleach in a 1 in 100 to 1 in 1,000 dilution as sort of a surface disinfectant, and used on visibly clean surfaces. It works very well that way. It is corrosive. It is inactivated by organic matter. And this always gets back to my clean before disinfecting mantra that I have to talk to everyone about. It does no good to pour bleach onto visibly soiled surfaces. It will be inactivated unless you get a dilution factor going where you eventually dilute the organic matter out enough that it will actually work. But I do recommend that cleaning before disinfecting step. If we utilize alcohol as our disinfectant, it offers, again, low to intermediate level disinfection. It has been used traditionally on thermometers, our oral thermometers sitting in our little vat of alcohol, stethoscopes to clean the bell off on those. And again, a stethoscope is a very low level, minimal risk item. And I've seen many staff members now utilizing an alcohol pledget that they unwrap, wipe off the bell of their stethoscope between patients. Alcohol has its drawback of being flammable and not being effective against some non-enveloped viruses. I just heard Monday, as a matter of fact, that there is some new data coming out of, I believe, Dr. Sitar's lab looking at a slightly higher concentration of alcohol to work against some of the non-enveloped viruses. And this is back in reference to tonometers being used in optometrist offices, where we've seen that there are some adenoviruses that are not killed by utilizing a 70% isopropyl alcohol. And I think we're going to see some research coming out here very soon on different concentrations handling some of these viruses. The hydrogen peroxide, again, our store-bought or drugstore-bought 3% hydrogen peroxide offers us a low-level disinfection. The industry standards of 6% or accelerated hydrogen peroxide products, depending on what you concentration you use it at, offers you various levels. Some of these products, the accelerated hydrogen peroxide at a 0.5%, will offer you low and intermediate level disinfection in a fairly quick contact time of 5 to 10 minutes. Up in the 7% range of the accelerated hydrogen peroxide, we can achieve sterility in terms of actually being sporicidal in 2 to 6 hours. And again, with most of these products, you have to check the manufacturer's label claims on what they're recommending to achieve the intermediate high level or sterilization levels, the contact time, and then again the recommendations for how to treat the product after it has come out of the soaking solution. As mentioned briefly, the quaternary ammonium compounds, or quats, really offer you only a low level disinfection unless they are mixed with something else. I was reading up on the products that we use in barbershops to soak the combs in and stuff, which is basically a quaternary ammonium compound, but they have added other solutions to that. The one ingredient list that I saw included isopropyl alcohol to help boost the level of disinfection that you're achieving there. In essence, our quaternary ammonium compounds are used mainly on floors and on surfaces, our less critical areas. I do want to discuss the cleaning of fixed equipment and exam tables in particular. We went through a VRE outbreak many years ago, and part of the hospital was affiliated with an ambulatory care clinic, and we took a real good look at the concept of the sheet of paper down the middle of the examination table and what does that actually afford you. And that seems to get changed definitely between patients, but we felt that it was really not offering much except an aesthetic or a visual to the patient. If there was gross soiling going on, as far as I could see, it was going to soak right through that paper quickly. I think exam tables do need to be wiped between patients on a routine basis, and I've made recommendations that way in audits that I have done. And if you have a spray disinfectant in a bottle or a good cleaner disinfectant on a surface that is visibly clean, we give it a wipe between patients. It's a nice sanitizing step that we're doing here. I don't even know if we're approaching disinfection with some of the solutions that we're using. Anything that's visibly soiled with body fluid, we need to have a written procedure in place to actually clean that and then sanitize it or disinfect it. The written procedure is very, very important so that we're doing this in a very consistent manner. There are many products that achieve a low to intermediate level disinfection at a very low concentration that you can look at to utilize on your exam tables. And again, what I'm trying to get at with the exam table concept is we don't need to worry if a patient has MRSA or VRE or an antibiotic-resistant organism if we're cleaning consistently between every patient. I think that takes us away from having to worry about if the patient has MRSA, we have to wipe down the table and the exam room and all the touch areas. Any touch areas, if it's that critical, we should be doing between patients. always been my feeling in this example. The waiting room should be cleaned at the end of the day. I found that a very consistent recommendation. Surfaces must be able to be wiped. You don't want cloth chairs. You want something that will actually be able to be wiped off. And magazines should be disposed of if they appear soiled. I think that's sort of a broad statement. I found that in a couple of my references, specifically the one from the College of Physicians and Surgeons here. I've also read a couple of articles about culturing of these magazines, and yes, they do harbor bacteria, as would our environment. And I think it's a recognition that we have to have as consumers, that if I go to a doctor's office and look at a magazine, I sort of need to wash my hands before I put it into my mouth. It's good general hygiene that's going to protect us. At the same time, I think it wouldn't hurt for doctor's offices to sort of keep track and make sure that magazines are disposed of on a time basis, if nothing else. I know many of us like to look back 10, 12 years at our various magazines to see what was going on at that time, but those magazines probably shouldn't still be in the doctor's office, and we just need to boost up our subscription rates, I think, here to make sure. I did find a reference that, viruses like RSV, influenza, parainfluenza, and the SARS virus do survive long enough on inanimate surfaces that they can be transmitted through an indirect contact method where someone could come in and touch that surface and inoculate themselves. And we should just be consistent in the cleaning of our waiting rooms. Toys. What to do? Well, after I've been around to some facilities, we seem to get rid of the toy box out of the waiting room on my recommendation. If we are going to have toys present, they really need to be cleaned after use. I did that with a question mark on the slide, but I firmly believe that at all possible, these things should be sanitized after they have been cleaned or sprayed with some form of a disinfectant that leaves no residue. I listed the hydrogen peroxide agent here because they generally break down to oxygen and water, but you need to check the label. And if a product that you're using to clean toys indicates that it's not to be used on food surface preparation areas or it needs to be rinsed afterwards, I'd be hesitant about using it on a toy that might be mouthed by a baby. Obviously, no cloth or plush toys should be available in waiting rooms. The play stations and the busy stations should be wiped down at least daily. What I recommended in the acute care hospital that I did work at is we had a pediatric play area, and this is in a pediatric ward, so we know the children are ill, but the toys were only used once, and then they were placed into a bin. We had a child life worker that was present at all times to make sure that the toys were not being reshelved, and then at the end of the day, they were cleaned in hot soapy water, they were dried off, they were sprayed with a disinfectant at a hospital grade level and left air dry as the product did not require rinsing, and then they were put back into circulation. The hospital now that I'm at, which has a palliative care unit, just approached me about putting toys out for the younger members that are coming in during the palliative stage in someone's life, and I'm going to use much the same practice. They're fine to have them there as long as they're not plush and as long as they're cleaned after use. And apparently this is going to be an aspect of our volunteer services to make sure that this happens. I've always been uncomfortable with toys. I mentioned to the crowd of people that I was coming in to work with today that this presentation was coming up, and both moms said right away, I would never let my child play with toys in a doctor's office. I think we may need to make that decision. Do we have them or don't we have them? I think at times it's easier just for everyone around to be able to assign the child to something to keep them busy. But I know as a parent, in my own experience, I would generally take toys with me to keep my child busy so that they wouldn't play with other things. If we look at what we need to do with the staff, we should, in doctor's offices, have very clear guidelines for our staff immunizations, making sure they're up to date. I apologize on this slide for not having polio listed. I do have mumps, measles, rubella, tetanus, our varicella vaccinations, now that we have that available for susceptible staff. Hepatitis B vaccine should be offered to anyone who has any possibility of blood exposure. And again, if we have our staff members cleaning equipment that might have blood or body fluids on it, they should be hepatitis B immune. The annual influenza vaccination is that time of year, folks. Those of you that haven't got that message out there, we need to get that out. And then don't forget about the pneumovax for our at-risk staff that should have that on board. Some form of a documentation process is very handy to have to check to make sure that this is in place and up to date. The next slide talks about an exposure protocol. I didn't go into great detail on this because the reference at the bottom there is for the infection control in the physician's office that was put out by the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario 2004. I may disagree with them on their MRSA recommendations, but they have a very good section in there on exposure protocols, both for HIV and hepatitis B follow-ups. As I mentioned earlier, they also have some charts in there for following up with your autoclaves and cleaning procedures. The website is there. This is a downloadable publication, and it has, as I've said, its pros and cons. They actually recommend in there when you're setting up your exposure protocols to check with an infectious disease expert or to check with your local medical officer of health through the public health area. So to wrap up here, what I'd like to do is hope I've left you with the concept that we need to assume that every patient is infectious and has potentially left us something lying around in the waiting room. I want to get people away from the panic around methicillin-resistant Staph aureus or vancomycin-resistant enterococci. The issue around Clostridium difficile, if we have a patient coming in with ongoing diarrhea that has been on antibiotics, you're starting to get suspicious about C. difficile. If they have not fecally soiled our environment, do we really have to worry that much? We have to assume that every patient coming in can make you, the doctor, or the office staff, or your next patient sick, and clean and perform functions in the office in a very consistent manner so that there's no issues around that. I don't think we can perform hand hygiene too much. I know in some of the lectures that I do where I'm demonstrating how often I can use alcohol without rotting my hands off, I do get comments on that afterwards. It's very important for us to have written policies in place. I think offices should do internal audits and perhaps external audits with the use of consultants. And if you have your own medical clinic or doctor's office, check around, check with your local hospital if there's an infection control practitioner that could come and offer you another set of eyes that could look at some of the issues that are in your office and maybe make some suggestions on things that you could do. One of the issues that I didn't mention in here that I'm noticing more and more locally is the presence of alcohol hand sanitizer on the entrance to the building. And again, at that sign where you're asking them if they're coughing, sneezing, snorting, if they have a fever, it doesn't hurt to have something there for them to sanitize their hands. We've developed a sign for my facility that basically states, please make use of our hand sanitizing station. We have further signs for on the floors where it would list all the different times that we would expect you to be using the alcohol. And I think this is a nice component of the office. The whole issue around hand hygiene and stuff, I'm also emphasizing to people, I'll do my little plug for my hand hygiene here. I still emphasize that I appreciate if someone enters an examination room sanitizing their hands or walk into the examination room, wash their hands, and then refer to me to find out what's going on. I've worked with some medical professionals that did this on a very routine basis. As they came into the examination room, they would walk to the sink and wash their hands. Regardless of what they had just done or where they had been, it was their way of coming into the room and starting the exam procedure. And as a consumer, I found that very nice to see. Again, I don't think we can perform the hand hygiene too much. So I see we still have a few minutes here. That's generally the end of my presentation. Are there any questions?
Well, thank you very much, Jim. Another very clear and coherent teleclass, and as always, very useful. Thank you very much. Jim, you mentioned that quaternary ammonium chlorides are useful for cleaning floors and surfaces. Do you endorse using a disinfectant on the floors of doctor's offices?
I don't think that's necessary, Paul, unless they have been visibly soiled with the body fluid. The area that I think we may need to look at using a disinfectant on a routine basis may be in the public washroom areas where we have to assume the floor is going to be soiled with urine and potentially with feces. But I think for routine use in a doctor's office, we probably don't need to disinfect the floor. I think we need to use a product that cleans very well, and we have to clean in a manner so that we're not just redistributing the dirt as we work our way down the hallway. I'm a firm believer in more of a single-use kind of cleaning system. However, you can set that up on the floor without using product names. But I know we have new mopping systems out where you basically utilize a covered mop. You remove the cover. It can be washed or disposed of. But I'm always worried with any cleaning process that we do that as soon as you go back and dip your mop and run it through that wringer again, you're going to start spreading stuff around on the floor. Even if you have a disinfectant present in your water, you're still going to overcome that disinfectant capabilities as the water gets dirty. And I think we need to really look at our cleaning procedure that we utilize. Now, most doctor's offices will have an outside agency come in to clean, and it is something that you may want to check to see how they are doing that to make sure that they're not spreading more bacteria around through their cleaning procedures than what was there in the original case.
Speaking of procedures, what about above floor surfaces?
On a routine basis, at the end of the day, I'm thinking any touch surface, so countertops, armrests of chairs, that kind of area, taps, should all be done at the end of the day for
sure.
What
kind of a technique would you recommend?
Single dip has always been my recommendation that I'm working towards in all of my facilities, where you have either a bottle that will put your disinfectant solution on a cloth that you then wipe the surface. Spray bottles are having some issues depending on what you're using because of the aerosolization, where you have a bucket of a cleaning slash disinfectant solution, whatever you're comfortable with, that you dip into once. You utilize the cloth on the touch area. That cloth then goes off to be disposed of or recycled or washed. You then take a clean cloth, dip into the clean solution again. I always have had worries about going back into our disinfectant solutions with a cloth after wiping a surface. And it's a process I think we're going to see become passe, hopefully within the next 2 to 3 years.
One last question before I open the line for questions, if I manage to leave time for that. Waiting rooms and outside services, certainly a lot of doctors' offices, my own doctor included, has a contractor come in and clean his office once a week. And thinking of all the things that are in that waiting room where you recommended daily, is that something we really need to look at, or can once a week be sufficient?
I think it goes back to the comfort level of if you have somebody with MRSA, as much as I don't like using that, if you had somebody with MRSA come through your waiting room, wait 15 to 20 minutes for their appointment because it's a busy day, go into the examination room and come out again, what do you want to do? Because you have to assume that if you know there was one MRSA patient that you saw this week, that you probably had one or two others that we just didn't know about. And are you comfortable with that waiting room having potential to have other organisms lying there? We've got viruses. During the SARS outbreak, we know that the SARS virus was probably viable for upwards of 24 hours in the environment. Are we comfortable after an overnight stay having patients come back into this area that might be immunocompromised? My personal gut feeling is I would like to see the daily cleaning, and it may be way overkill, but I'm in the field that I'm in, and I tend to be a bit of a neat freak that way.
Just as well that you are, too. I see that we are 26 minutes past the hour, and I think maybe I won't open the line for questions. However, if you do have a question, you are, of course, welcome to email it to me. Jim is outstandingly proficient at getting back to answering questions. If you email it to me, I will get it to him. He will get it back to both of us. So if you have a question, my email address is at the bottom of your handout and also on the title slide, the first slide of the PowerPoint presentation. Jim also did a teleclass last year called Infection Control and Daycare Centers, and that was created into a enhanced recording on CD. If you'd like a copy of this CD, they are available for sale, and a portion of the proceeds, a large portion of the proceeds, goes to Chica Canada to help promote infection control in Canada. If you email to me, I will give you a list of all the CDs we have available and how you can go about ordering them. Our next teleclass is scheduled for next Tuesday, that's the 15th, on ESBL bacteria. Now, that teleclass is in our British teleclass series, but it will be rebroadcast to North America at 1:30 in the afternoon Eastern Time. In December, we have Robert Garcia presenting on preventing ventilator-assisted pneumonia. June Wu from Health Canada will present on bloodborne pathogen control. And Michelle Alpha will round out the teleclass year with a teleclass entitled Clostridium difficile environmental survival. And I believe that's talking at least in part of the survival of the organism before it sporulates, when it can do the most damage. I think that's going to be a very interesting talk. Looking forward to that. Thanks again to the folk at Johnson Diversey for their sponsorship and their continuing support. Thanks to Jim again for your fabulous presentation. As always, well done. Thank you very much. And to everyone who has joined us, thank you very much. I hope you will join us again next time. And until then, goodbye.